Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. I love stories about works of art that one way or another define American culture. Books and movies and TV shows and plays and buildings and songs that have really changed the way we see and understand ourselves. For the last decade, we have been digging into these artifacts as part of our American Icons series. On today's show, we've got three of them. Coming-of-age novels are usually written and published a long time after the authors actually came of age. But there was one writer who captured the American adolescent moment when she was right in the middle of it.
I lived The Outsiders. I think that's why it's so immediate to people, because I was in that book living it.
That's the author S.E. Hinton talking about writing The Outsiders and the film it inspired. But to start things off, an American icon that at first blush doesn't seem very American at all. If you tried to come up with a fictional character least likely to endure as a major figure in our pop culture, a pretty good one would be a middle-aged Jewish milkman in a Russian village in 1905 singing in Yiddish.
If I were a rich man, I have a dibbidibbidibbidibbidibbidum. All day long I dibbidibbidibbum. If I were a wealthy man.
But then the musical Fiddler on the Roof opened on Broadway.
Oh, Lord, you made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, it's no shame to be poor. But it's no great honor either.
Tevye is poor, his daughters are rebelling against tradition, and there's a pogrom around the corner. Which, in the mid-1960s, turned out, who knew, to be the perfect recipe for gigantic theatrical success. Fiddler is now back on Broadway in a new production, The Sixth. When the show celebrated its 50th anniversary a couple of years ago, I asked WNYC's Jim O'Grady to figure out why and how it happened.
Producer Hal Prince sits in his office in Rockefeller Center and recalls a difficult meeting held there in 1961, which to him seems like yesterday. On one side of the table are three of Broadway's rising stars, lyricist Sheldon Harnick, composer Jerry Bock, and librettist Joe Stein. They've already got Tony Awards and Pulitzer Prizes under their belts. But across from them is a guy you do not want to mess with, director Jerome Robbins. Prince calls him Jerry, and Jerry Robbins is a titan of the New York stage, fresh from winning a Tony and Academy Award for West Side Story. He is used to giving orders, and now he's grilling the three men about their script for Fiddler.
Jerry kept saying, but what's this show about? And the usual answer was, well, it's about this milkman who has five daughters, and how can he marry them off? And then somebody'd say, it's about a pogrom.
He would say, no, that's the plot.
That's lyricist Sheldon Harnick.
That's not what gives these stories their power, and that's what we have to find out.
The two sides went back and forth.
Jerry said, but what the hell is this show really about?
Until Harnick had enough.
Finally, Sheldon blew his stack and said, Jerry, what are you talking about? What's it about? I mean, it's about tradition. What else is it about? And Jerry said, that's what I've been hoping somebody would tell me. Now write a song called Tradition.
Here in Anatevka, we have our traditions for everything. How to eat, how to sleep, how to work, even how to wear clothes. For instance, we always keep our heads covered. And we wear these little prayer shawls. This shows our constant devotion to God. You may ask, how did this tradition get started? I'll tell you, I don't know. But it's a tradition.
Harnick says that's Fiddler's dramatic core, the fight between old ways and new.
You know, the Enlightenment that started in Western Europe percolated east and hit these little shtetls, and people's lives began to change. They began to break away from these traditions. And that's what's happening in this show.
He was making the show about something that made sense to Japanese, Middle Easterners, any group of people who have tradition. and every group of people has tradition.
By the time Fiddler reached Broadway, Tevye and his traditions had been around for 70 years. He was born in the late 19th century in the imagination of a sickly but charismatic man from Kiev who wrote in Yiddish. His name is Sholem Aleichem.
Sholem Aleichem is a pen name. It means howdy, you know, how you doing?
Alyssa Solomon is a professor at the Columbia School of Journalism.
He was one of the most beloved writers in a very short time, speaking to poor people, poor Jews, in their common language.
Solomon researched Sholem Aleichem's life for her book, Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof.
He would give readings around the Pale of Settlement, and thousands would flock to hear him, and he apparently was a great speaker.
At the time, the Pale of Settlement covers 500,000 square miles between the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea. Sholem Aleichem writes the first of 8 stories about Tevye the Milkman in 1894. He raises the stakes by placing the fictional Jewish market town of Anatevka in the Pale, in the middle of anti-Semitic imperial Russia. It just gives you the feeling that stuff's going to get nasty. The Tevye stories turn out to be popular with Sholem Aleichem's fans, but what he really wants is to have a hit play in America.
He's in his 40s, it's 1905, and he comes here because he needs to make money. He has this great idea that he's going to strike it rich in the Yiddish theater in New York.
He gets off to a flying start. The two biggest producers in Yiddish theater compete to be the first to open a play by Sholem Aleichem. He ends up opening 2 shows on the same night.
Both of them flop. They don't really get Americans. This new class of people, even though they might be recent immigrants, they're making a new life here in America. And Sholem Aleichem's work is really just about the old country in a way that isn't helping them grapple with what's going on with them in their new homes. Or maybe they just weren't very good plays. I mean, there's also that.
Sholem Aleichem borrows money and sails back to Europe. He writes a new play based on the Tevye stories. He calls it Tevye the Milkman. The play debuts in New York in 1919, but Sholem Aleichem has died 3 years earlier of influenza. This time, his play is a hit. So what changed between his early failures on the Yiddish stage and his posthumous success?
What happened? Well, World War I happened. It's hard for us to think about this now post-Holocaust, when we know that Eastern European Jewish culture was pretty much wiped off the map. But from the perspective of 1919, Jewish culture had just been wiped off the map.
Allowing Jewish Americans to view the shtetl not as a backwater they'd escaped, but as a place suffused with nostalgia. Also, Joe Stein changed the ending of Aleichem's play. The Tsar's police still evict Tevye and his family from Anatevka, but crucially, Stein has them set off for the United States.
And 2 generations later, the grandchildren of the Tevyes are sitting in the Broadway audience, knowing how well, in fact, they have done.
Tradition!
When Fiddler opened in 1964, Americans were beginning to embrace their ethnic roots. The country's myth of origin was shifting from Plymouth Rock to Ellis Island. And making Tevye a would-be immigrant helped non-Jews relate to him and his struggles.
The Tevye character is trying to hold on and trying to change and shift and bend and acclimate as necessary in order to keep things going, to keep peace in his home, and to understand himself. He makes error after error in these stories in terms of his daughters, and he never quite comes to, for readers, he never quite comes to satisfactory self-realization. That's part of the tension in the stories that's so beautiful.
Joe Stein first came across Sholem Aleichem's Tevye stories in 1960. He showed them to Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, and they all saw right away that Fiddler the Musical would hinge on the singing milkman. He has to be exasperating, yet sympathetic, Shakespearean in one scene and vaudevillian in the next. and they agree Tevye must be played by the comic actor Zero Mostel. But
everybody wondered when Zero was approached whether he would choose to do the show, because he and Jerome Robbins had huge political differences.
Both Zero Mostel and Jerome Robbins had been called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. That was back in the era of the communist witch hunts, and the committee wanted them to name names. Robbins did, Mostel did not.
There was bad blood between them. The first day of rehearsal, Zero was there. Everyone was waiting for Robbins to come in to see how Zero would react. And finally, Robbins came in, and everybody got quiet, and Zero looked at him and said, "Hi there, blabbermouth." Well, Robbins just threw back his head and roared with laughter, which gave everybody else permission to laugh, and that broke the ice.
I knew the show had kind of an irresistible quality about it, and I knew it was going to be a hit.
Oh, well, let's talk about that. So this show...
Oh, by the way, No, I'm going to interrupt you.
Please,
the reviews
please.
Were lousy.
That's right. Hal Prince says that during out-of-town tryouts, critics panned the show.
And then when we got to Broadway, the reviews were good. Not great. Good. Caviling a little bit.
Here's to our prosperity, our good health and happiness, and most important, to life, l'chaim.
But strong word of mouth drew lines around the block. Fiddler was off and running.
Here's to the father I try to be.
Here's to my bride-to-be.
Drink l'chaim, to life, l'chaim.
So on the anniversary, when it became the longest running show on Broadway, I reprinted all the reviews on gold paper and put them in a little booklet and gave them to the audience.
Did that satisfy your lust for vengeance on the critics?
It's not a lust for vengeance. It's an irony. I'm smiling, aren't I?
Oh, Hal Prince is smiling as he hops on the intercom with his assistant.
Nancy, what is the payoff on Fiddler to the investor?
A couple of minutes later, Nancy comes in with a letter.
Here we go. I'll read this letter to you.
Prince has produced and directed dozens of Broadway plays over his 60-year career, and he's pretty sure that Fiddler has yielded his biggest payday.
This brings the total profit return to 3,884%.
And if our good fortune never comes, here's to whatever comes. Break Ohio!
Fiddler on the Roof is playing this year on almost 200 stages in Bangalore, India, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and at Asa Clark Middle School in Pewaukee, Wisconsin.
Oh, Papa, I don't want to marry him. I can't marry him. I'll be unhappy with him. All my life will be unhappy.
But we made an agreement. With us, an agreement is none.
One, two, one, two. Life, L'chaim.
Everybody repeat after me. L'chaim.
L'chaim.
CR is a little girl thing, right? Yeah. L'chaim.
L'chaim to life. Here's to the father I try to be.
Here's to my bride-to-be.
Drink l'chaim to life.
I ask Elisa Solomon how many times she thinks the songs in the show have been covered by other artists.
Well, if I had to be precise, I'd say gazillions.
Gazillions. That is a lot. Cannonball Adderley.
There was a Latin version by Joe Quijano. Miriam Makeba.
Is this the little girl I carry? Is this the little boy at play?
Sheldon Harnick remembers one particular call he got in 2003.
There's a rock artist named Dr. Dre, or Dr. Dre, I don't know how he pronounces his name.
That would be Dr. Dre. He's a producer, more of a rapper, but go on.
And he said he wanted to do a girl's version of If I Were a Rich Man, If I Were a Rich Girl.
That's the Gwen Stefani song that Dr. Dre produced. The point is, Fiddler is still rattling around and relevant at age 50, and that's good for Fiddler consultant Gary John LaRosa. He acted in the show in the 1990s, and now theaters around the country fly him in to help them stage it.
Over the last 30 years, I have probably directed or choreographed over 24 productions of the show recreating the Robbins choreography.
La Rosa was a 9-year-old Italian-American Catholic kid when he first set eyes on Fiddler on the Roof. Today, he knows every moment, every gesture in the show, in detail.
All of the choreography is either evocative of something or telling the story of what's happening, for example.
He does have a favorite moment. It comes toward the end when Tevye gets the news that his daughter Hava has defied him and run off with a man outside the faith.
And he sits on the edge of his cart and remembers her as a child, which is his way of trying to hold on to something, because he knows that he has already told Golda that she is dead to us. And so...
Is this making you emotional to talk about this?
Yes.
Really, why?
This is the power of the show.
The power of the show is in how it takes a Yiddish story about Jewish life in a particular time and place and makes it universal. Anna Tevye becomes a stand-in for whichever old country you identify with. And Tevye, with his prayer shawl and pleading with his children, becomes every immigrant father. I spoke to a guy named Hossein Amri, a Muslim in his 50s who left Iran as a young man, came to America, and raised a family. He's watched Fiddler on the Roof 6 times and cried 6 times.
My favorite part is the Anna Tevye song, the very last end of the movie, because it reminds me when I left. I'm glad that I came out and I was able to succeed abroad, but you know, you have to leave your family behind. Every aspect of the movie that I saw, that could be totally universal and apply to everybody, everyone in every corner of the world.
May the Lord protect and defend you. May he always shield you from shame. May you come to be in Israel a shining name.
Thanks to Jim O'Grady for that story. You can hear more of Jim on the new WNYC Studios podcast, There Goes the Neighborhood. Still ahead on this special American Icons Hour, movie stills from movies that were never made.
You just know at the end of the film that she's going to die, that there's something foreboding. There's this Hitchcockian, you know, violence that's kind of lurking underneath.
Cindy Sherman's untitled film stills. That's the next American Icon in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. A few decades ago, Cindy Sherman turned a childhood spent watching late-night movies on TV into a series of photographs, these fictional self-portraits that are fascinating and weirdly haunting. That series is called Untitled Film Stills. They're now some of the most famous art photographs ever, endlessly referenced in pop culture. The actor-slash-artist James Franco has made his own homage-slash-recreations of the pictures. Anne Hepperman looked into why untitled film stills became such a big deal that endure.
Cindy Sherman's untitled film stills just feel familiar. Like untitled film still number 21.
People often call it the City Girl.
Which I'm looking at right now with Museum of Modern Art curator Eva Ruspini.
No, here it is, yeah.
It's a black and white 8x10 photo, and in it, you see a young woman surrounded by big city office towers.
There's no question that she's in Manhattan. Here she is.
And she's dressed like a 1950s, fresh-off-the-bus career girl from Kansas.
She's got her, you know, hat and her little suit on, and she's, you know, trying to get a job.
The picture's shot from below, with Sherman's face front and center. But what you really notice are her eyes.
Her expression seems kind of fearful, maybe a little bit lonely.
They're looking at something or someone just outside the frame.
But this, to me, implies that someone's maybe watching her. You just know at the end of the film that she's going to die, that there's something foreboding. There's this Hitchcockian, you know, violence that's kind of lurking underneath. That's definitely the film, you know, taking over.
Cindy Sherman has somehow created an entire movie around what looks like one frame of film. 70 different images make up the untitled film stills. And they're meant to look cheap, like photos you'd find in a thrift store. Sherman changes her hair and her outfits to act out a whole range of 1950s and 60s B-movie and art house cliches, like the career girl.
I think this application is filled out all right, Mr. Arnold.
Thank you.
The bombshell.
I have to live as if every day were my last one. Something powerful in me that makes me behave foolishly.
And the housewife.
Like so many people these days, we live in the suburbs.
Cindy Sherman started making the untitled film stills in 1977. At first, she'd dress up, rearrange the furniture, and shoot photos of herself. This was in the Soho loft that she shared with her then-boyfriend and fellow artist, Robert Longo.
And then she had this idea about wanting to go out.
She'd stuff a suitcase with clothes and wigs and throw them in the back of their van.
It was like a hippie van. And we'd drive to locations and she would change in the back and then come out of the van a different character. It would always be quite hideous sometimes. She looked pretty weird sometimes.
When she worked outside, Sherman often had family or friends snap the pictures. Helene Weiner owned the Artist Space Gallery where Cindy Sherman worked. She shot untitled film still number 83. Sherman told Weiner, "Stand over there and take some pictures as I walk down the street."
I thought, oh, these are going to be the worst ones, the most terrible ones, because she's not doing anything.
What came out, though, looks like a shot from some European movie.
You know, a Italian movie star fleeing from the press or not wanting to be recognized.
Sherman's wearing a black wig and sunglasses cover her face, and she seems to be rushing across the square. Her expressions are subtle, but evocative. Unlike real film stills, Sherman did not go for the over-the-top look. MoMA's Eva Ruspini.
They would actually fail completely as actual publicity stills in that they don't show the climax of the movie or the most, you know, important scene, or they don't convey the narrative in the way that publicity stills were set up to do, and that blankness is a kind of stand-in for whatever you as the viewer want to believe about that character.
The woman's, like, cheating husband has driven a car off the pier that she had rigged.
Oh, I loved those. It looked so like Berlin in some spy novel.
The moment where I picture her shifting from feeling sorry for herself to, you know what, I am going to get out of here now.
Sherman brought some of the untitled film stills into the Artist Space Gallery, where she worked as a part-time receptionist.
We went crazy over them. I mean, I'm sure if the janitor was standing there, he would have known that this was something very, very special.
The untitled film stills didn't linger as some wallflower art project. Everyone loved them.
Collectors had never bought a photograph and would not buy it. Cindy was the only one people would actually purchase to own.
Critics loved the series, too. As one person put it, it seemed like you'd come upon the film stills in books, anthologies, and magazines more often than in a gallery or a museum.
Cindy Sherman, Untitled Film Stills, is known to every single art student.
That's Zoe Crosher. She's a contemporary artist in Los Angeles. I found her after Googling, "Untitled Film Stills Changed My Life."
It's slightly disconcerting because I said that in some offhand remark during some talk that I gave somewhere. But it did change my life.
Crosher remembers exactly how that influence worked on her. She was 19 and in college when she first saw the untitled film stills. She'd been struggling to find an artist who inspired her, especially a woman. There were women photographers, yes, but all their work was documentary. Grab a camera, go out into the world, and capture all the freaks that you can see. Then she saw the untitled film stills.
Suddenly here comes this complicated situation where I'm looking at something that's constructed, but it doesn't look like it's constructed. And this woman who's chameleon-like and changing the way that she presents herself, and she's also in control of the taking of all of these photographs, and this notion of agency that she, it sounds like she probably didn't even intend to have, which is the interesting, one of the interesting things about her and the history of her work, is that she's constantly, she's mute about everything she does.
And that's part of the mystery of Cindy Sherman. Even though she puts herself center stage in the images, she's extremely private. The artist was gracious about it, but eventually declined to talk for the story. And for a lot of people, Sherman's silence just adds to the layers of ambiguity in the untitled film stills.
Would I like to have a conversation with her? Of course, but that's not important. Understanding her intent with this, like, that's completely not important. What's important is what I've decided is important about it to me.
Jim Adkins is the lead singer of Jimmy Eat World. And a few years ago, he started using the untitled film stills as a writing exercise. And then it turned into an album, Invented.
I can't compete with the clear eyes of strangers.
Adkins says his backstories for the untitled film stills got quite elaborate. Like untitled film still number 36. That turned into a song called Evidence. In the photo, Sherman is just a silhouette of a woman. She's changing clothes, it looks like lingerie, and there's a cloth hanging right behind her.
Hang up the sheet between our things.
Maybe she moved into a place with a boyfriend and they got like a super awesome deal on a really small place in New York. You know, they break up. But neither of them really want to move out because they have such an awesome deal on this rent-controlled space. Just to get some sort of privacy, she just staples this bedsheet to the ceiling in between their space. And the dude, you know, has no choice but to kind of, you know, stew in this tension.
I think what's brilliant about the untitled film stills and about Cindy's work in general is you don't need a PhD in order to get them. And I think the work is smart, perceptive, elegant, provocative, but accessible. And accessibility here is not a bad word.
And because they're so accessible, so easy to grab onto, the untitled film still stories become our narratives. It's like there's some kind of art Rorschach test. The stories we tell about them reveal something about us. Even more so now, says Eva Ruspini, when so many of us are constructing stories with photographs.
You know, all of those things are about facades. The selfie's not about who you really are. It's about how you look best in the camera to your friends, creating this, you know, narrative of what you're doing and how great that seems.
I love you too.
Getting married.
Is that your sissy?
Yeah.
And that's what the work is about. It's really about manufactured identities.
And who knows how we'll be feeling in 30 plus years about our own selfies. Truthfully, I'm a little sick of these pictures. Cindy Sherman wrote in 1997, when MoMA displayed the untitled film stills together for the first time, "It's funny to see some of them now. Funny, because while people have been generating mental movies from the untitled film stills, Sherman looks at them and sees this. Herself on a certain day, decades ago, dressed a certain way, acting out a certain scenario. She isn't the person in the untitled film stills anymore. That person is us."
Thanks to Anne Hepperman for that story. Since it first aired, Eva Ruspini has become chief curator at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston. And Cindy Sherman is back with her first new work in 5 years. She's 62 years old now, and these new pictures depict her as the aging stars of early Hollywood, Greta Garbo, Gloria Swanson, and so on. You can see some of those new photographs, along with a bunch from her Untitled Film Still series, at studio360.org. Coming up, S.E. Hinton was a student at Will Rogers High School in Tulsa when she wrote her novel, The Outsiders.
Some of its faults, like its over-the-top emotions and, the drama, are what make it so popular because that's the way kids really feel. You got to have the hormones going before you can really appreciate that book.
It takes a teenager to know one. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. And if you're going to be in New York on Tuesday, May 10th, you really should join me for a special live edition of the show. We're teaming up with the Story Collider for a night of storytellers, true, funny, surprising stories about science. We've got a great lineup, including Wyatt Cenac and the stand-up comedian Aparna Nancherla. You can get tickets at studio360.org. Our last story today is about a groundbreaking young adult novel. In fact, the groundbreaking young adult novel. In the late 1960s, it made publishers see that adolescents were attracted to books that weren't preachy or treacly, or about the Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew solving the mystery. They wanted realistic stories about the very sweet pain of growing up. S.E. Hinton was a teenager herself in 1967 when she published her novel about rival groups in her hometown of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Outsiders was an instant hit. And then it became one all over again when Francis Ford Coppola made it into a movie starring Hollywood Dreamboats 1983, Patrick Swayze, Rob Lowe, Matt Dillon, and Tom Cruise. I asked Lou Olkowski to find out why this story has spoken to three generations of American kids and counting.
I made a D in creative writing the year I was writing The Outsiders. I love bringing that up.
Susan Eloise Hinton was a sophomore at Will Rogers High School in Tulsa when she began The Outsiders. You probably know her as S.E.
The use of my initials came about because my publishers didn't want the first reviewers to see a book about social class warfare, mainly about boys, and see it was written by a girl and think, well, a girl wouldn't know anything about this. But one day when a friend of mine got beat up on his way home from school, I got mad and began a short story. And that was the beginning of The Outsiders.
When I spotted that red Corvair trailing me, I was almost two blocks from home then, so I started walking a little faster.
Set in the early 1960s, The Outsiders is about a bunch of poor kids, the greasers, who are terrorized by the rich kids, the socias.
I had never been jumped, but I had seen Johnny after four socias got a hold of him, and it wasn't pretty.
It's told from the perspective of Pony Boy, one of the youngest greasers. Like Nick Carraway from The Great Gatsby, that other great book about social class, Pony Boy watches it all.
I remember Johnny, his face all cut up and bruised, and I remember how he had cried when we found him, half conscious in the corner lot.
I lived The Outsiders. I think that's why it's so immediate to people, because I was in that book living it.
Missy Hinton still lives in Tulsa, and she still drives past the places that inspired the book.
I will take you through the Socias neighborhood. It's where the old oil mansions are.
I have to say, it's hard to not feel kind of poor driving through this neighborhood.
No kidding. As you can see, the rich people here are very rich. I mean, very rich. And the pockets of poverty are very, very poor. So you do have two extremes.
The extremes were most obvious in how kids dressed. The socias wore button-down shirts.
Meanwhile, the greasers, you know, blue jeans, white T-shirts, black leather jackets. And, of course, anybody could dress like that, but you wouldn't do it unless you were a greaser. Next stop is going by the high school. Back there in the back parking lot was where the greasers hung out, but the socias hung out in that main entrance, so you just didn't use that entrance.
The greaser kids would actually come into school from the other door?
Oh, yeah. You didn't go through that door. Unless you were soaked. But it wasn't, like, imposed by the adults, the school, or your parents, or anything. It was kids imposing rules on themselves.
In fact, adults barely show up in The Outsiders. It's an all-teenage world, created by a teenager.
I started off typing on my father's It was an antique, even then, Underwood. And, man, I must have had some muscles in my fingers, because I still have that thing, and it's not easy to...
Hey, Grease, one said in an over-friendly voice. We're going to do you a favor, Greaser. We're going to cut all that long, greasy hair off.
At one point, Ponyboy and his best friend Johnny get jumped by the Socs again. But this time, they fight back, and Johnny accidentally kills one of them with a switchblade.
Something bad can happen at any moment, and there's nothing you can do about it.
That's Elizabeth Bird. She works in the kids section at New York Public Library.
There's no higher power that they ever call upon at any moment. There's no trusted adult that they turn to when things are getting rough. It's entirely on themselves. And people die.
Circumstances under which I was writing, which I don't want to go into, but personally it was very, very difficult.
When she was 15, Hinton's father was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And the more and more time he spent in the hospital, the more time she spent writing.
One of the things I really loved about writing was getting to be in another world.
When Essie finished The Outsiders, she gave it to a friend whose mother wrote children's books. She thought it was good enough to go to an agent.
But I was idle conversation with my mother. I said, you know, if I ever sold my book, could I get a car? And she's going, sure, hon. You sell your book, you get a car. And my younger sister hears this, and she's like, sell your book, we'll get a car, we'll get a car. And she's the one that actually bundled it up and sent it off.
Viking, the second publisher to see it, snatched up the publishing rights, and Essie got her car.
It was the first year Camaros came out, so I got a Camaro, and my sister was running around going, I sent the book in, and she put the first dent in the car, too.
The Outsiders definitely changed things.
It led the way towards a whole new genre of writing for teenagers called New Realism.
And you got some very brave books. Prior to The Outsiders, there wasn't this established understanding that teens liked dark fiction, which is so funny today when you consider like the huge swaths of depressing teen literature that they just gobble up like crazy.
But for all of its realism, The Outsiders has some pretty far-fetched plot twists. After killing the Soch, Johnny and Ponyboy go on the run. Their friend Dally, the toughest and coolest of the greasers, gives them some money, a gun, and tells them to hide out in an abandoned church. Then there's a fire, and Johnny and Ponyboy rescue some little kids who just happen to be there.
There's a field trip at the abandoned church? Are you kidding me? Like, it makes no sense whatsoever.
And this is coming from a fan, Heather Och, a performer and high school drama teacher.
My first copy of The Outsiders was given to me by Mrs. Hark, who was my English teacher in junior high. I thought she was really cool. She wore dangly earrings. I just remember I loved it immediately. I really did.
Still, Heather remembers cringing when Johnny and Ponyboy kill time reading Gone with the Wind.
What little dudes are going to hang out and read Gone with the Wind to each other?
It doesn't have a reputation of being an ooey-gooey novel, even though it has some really, touching, sweet moments between them.
You ain't like any of the gang. I mean, I couldn't tell Tubit or Steve or even Derry about the sunrise and clouds and stuff. I mean, they just don't dig. Johnny shrugged. Yeah, he said with a sigh. I guess we're different.
Some of it's false, like it's over-the-top emotions. And, the drama are what make it so popular, because that's the way kids really feel. You gotta have the hormones going before you can really appreciate that book.
Which is why, every school year, there's a new generation of teenagers who eat it up. Back in 1983, one of those teens was Christy Bishop. She was an eighth grader at Lone Star Junior High School in Fresno, California.
I read it and then reread it and read it again and read it probably three more times.
Which meant Christy got to know the school librarian, Joellen Misakian, pretty well.
And so she's like, well, here, let's make a petition and we will send it off to Francis Ford Coppola. Just looking back at the petition, it's so cute because, it's seventh and eighth grade girly handwriting with big hearts and flowers and smiley faces.
I have a copy of that letter. Hi, I'm Ralph Macchio. I played Johnny Cade in the film The Outsiders. And that's just the greatest story. Coppola tells that story all the time.
Amazingly, the petition worked. As they began to adapt the story, Coppola's producer, Fred Roos, kept in touch with the students. Early on, Fred even asked for their feedback on the script. Joellen went to L.A. to give him notes in person.
I just said, Fred, we really don't like the script. It's not true to the book. We just don't like it.
It is kind of ballsy.
I know. You're right. You're right. It is ballsy.
But they rewrote the script. As the film was in production, Joellen organized conference calls with Coppola and the film's heartthrob cast.
Be quiet.
Matt Dillon, C. Thomas Howell.
No wiggling.
And Ralph Macchio.
Hello, is this Ralph Macchio?
Yeah, how are you?
That's so me.
Wow, we're just great. Go ahead, cheer.
Nearly 30 years later, Ralph Macchio still remembers the kids in Fresno.
I would like to know, how did you like your role in The Outsiders?
I like the role. I love The Outsiders. That book, I read the book in seventh grade. Same as most of you. And
I was obviously very excited.
Hi, I'm a teacher here at Lone Star School, and I'd like to know, what message would you like to get across to your audiences through this role?
Just believe in, yourself, because that was Johnny's problem in his whole life. He never believed in himself. He never had confidence in himself. He was always nervous he was going to get beat up again. And towards the end of the movie, he started gaining confidence in himself.
It was at that point before they go in to save the kids when Johnny starts telling Dallas what they're going to do.
We're going back. We're going to turn ourselves in.
What?
I got a good chance of being let off easy. It was self-defense. You just said Pony and Jerry can testify to that.
All of a sudden, you just see him come out of his shell.
So you won't get in any trouble, Dal.
Are you sure? This is what you want to do?
Yeah, I'm sure, man. It ain't fair for Dal.
It would be really interesting to see how Johnny would have progressed from that point, because there was he took the reins.
But Johnny never gets the chance. With Dally and Ponyboy at his side, he dies from the burns he got rescuing the kids in the church fire. But his experience of finding himself after being uncomfortable in his own skin rang true for thousands of teenagers.
If you're a freak, a weirdo, an outcast, an outsider in any way, you love those stories. You want those stories. And that really can help lift you up.
The other thing the book has going for it is sex appeal. It's a teenage girl's fantasy about teenage boys. And with the movie, Coppola ran with it. For Heather, the drama teacher, it was a major turn on.
I'm watching it and I'm like, oh my God, it's so homoerotic. Totally softcore porn for me. I mean, when Johnny kills the Soche, everybody gets wet. When the rumble happens, everybody gets wet. It's just like buff dudes in wet t-shirts, like, for a large portion of the movie. Oh, rich people trying to keep me down. We'll fight them. Great. Take your shirt off. Like, roll around in the mud. I want the rain coming down. Yes. Not only are you, like, muddy and rolling around, but you're, like, fighting the man.
The outsider, with his blue jeans, leather jacket, and slicked back hair, became Heather's romantic ideal.
I wanted this person. I wanted the person who was going to, read a poem and talk to me about the sunset and then would go kick somebody's ass if they were going to f*** with me.
But she didn't necessarily want a man. Heather knew she wasn't alone, so she decided to stage a live performance of The Outsiders.
In the role that was made famous by Ralph Macchio.
I love the story of The Outsiders. Who do I want to be in it? A bunch of random dudes? No. I want my world of people. Like, let's do this. This is for us.
Her people are gay or queer or butch or trans.
If you get cold.
Because there wasn't a book that was a bunch of queer freaks, doing what they were doing. Like, we placed ourselves on those white boys, We're like, yeah, they're standing up. They're standing up to the socias. They're standing up to the rich people. They're standing up to the people who are putting them down. We were able to, take that and make it our own.
Maybe The Outsiders continues to attract a wide audience because so many of us have felt bullied or marginalized and feel like there's always a group of insiders who live by different rules.
And you can't win against them, no matter how hard you try, because they've got all the breaks, and even whipping them isn't going to change that fact.
45 years later, the outsider story of class warfare is as relevant as ever. Again, librarian Betsy Bird.
That might be the element to it that has survived unchanged, then or now, that is always going to be the haves and the have-nots. You know, the divide is getting bigger and bigger all the time, and this book talks about that. A lot of books for teens and kids do not.
By the end of The Outsiders, Dally, the super tough guy, is so distraught by Johnny's death that he kills himself in a standoff with the cops. But for the rest of the greasers, everything goes back to the way it always was.
Ponyboy is poor at the outset of the novel, and he is poor at the end of the novel.
Eric Tribunella is a professor of children's literature at the University of Mississippi.
His older brother had wanted to be a football star and go to college, but he can't do that because he's got to stay home and take care of his younger brothers. And that is not resolved at the end of the novel because there is no resolution.
In the final tear-jerking pages, Ponyboy finds a goodbye letter from his friend Johnny.
Like green. When you're a kid, everything's new. Like the way you dig sunsets, Pony. That's gold. Keep it that way. It's a good way to be. And don't be so bugged over being a greaser. You still have a lot of time to make yourself be what you want. There's still lots of good in the world. Tell Dally. I don't think he knows.
It ends on what appears to be this hopeful note that Ponyboy is going to finish high school, that he's going to go off to college, and that maybe he will attain middle-class status and all will be well.
Which made sense to high school sophomore Susan Eloise Hinton. But now, in the age of the 99%, Ponyboy's future feels a little less hopeful.
The alternative is for Ponyboy to get a bunch of his friends and occupy Wall Street. I mean, the alternative is some kind of broader social movement. But that's not where Ponyboy goes. That's not where the novel goes.
Instead, as a response to Johnny's letter and as makeup work for his English class, Ponyboy writes the story of The Outsiders.
I could picture hundreds and hundreds of boys living on the wrong sides of cities. Boys with black eyes who jumped at their own shadows. Hundreds of boys who maybe watched sunsets and looked at stars and ached for something better. Someone should tell their side of the story.
I was just telling the truth about what I saw going on. You know, that part of it's timeless. The names and the uniforms change, but it doesn't matter.
There will always be outsiders. The only question is, can the outsiders ever find something better?
That was Lou Olkowski. We've got dozens more stories about this country's defining, enduring works of culture. They are all at studio360.org/American Icons. If you listen to everyone, maybe we'll give you an American Studies degree from Studio 360 University. And that is it for this week's show. We'll be back with a new one next week. In the meantime, you can always find us on Twitter. We're at Studio 360 Show, and I'm at KB Anderson. That's with an E-N. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team is always easy to spot.
Blue jeans, white t-shirts, black leather jackets.
They are
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Rickle,
Tommy Bizzeri,
Danielle Fox,
Kate Essett.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Studio 360's American Icons project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, on Broadway right now, Frank Langella is playing a guy losing his mind. He's had some practice. King Lear.
Lear is the great mountain to climb until you've climbed it, and then you sit down with every other actor who's ever played it, and you go, what the f*** was I thinking?
I'll talk with Frank Langella next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.